the people asking you, why is this greenhouse sitting right next to the placard of Malcolm X? I just tell them that it's built on these four pillars: self-preservation, self-determination, having a space to clear one's mind, and then it starts with this space being a food desert. I have a ton of knowledge about agriculture because I'm from Iowa, so it's the number one agricultural powerhouse in the entire U.S. You can see what happens to land when indigenous peoples are kicked off of it. In Iowa, we have less than 1% of indigenous land left.
That was artist and activist Jordan Weber in an Instagram video where he's describing a meditation center / greenhouse that he designed and helped to construct in honor of Malcolm X, actually, in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. We're going to have Jordan on the show a little bit later on to talk about that particular project, as well as get his take on Black activism in the Midwest. Welcome back to the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. It's your guy, Larry from Iowa. Big thanks to everyone who's subscribed to the podcast, and thanks to everybody that's rated it. Please follow us on Instagram at Chip in the Cookie Pod. Also, I know I've been switching up a lot of my handles lately. I'm just trying to get everything uniformed. You can catch me on Twitter at Larry from Iowa, all the way spelled out. I know I gave you guys a different Twitter handle last week. Just ignore that, please. Also, thanks to everyone that has donated to the show behind the scenes. Our Cash App is live and active. So if you feel so compelled, please donate to the show. Our Cash App tag is Chip and Cookie Pod. So it's actually the same as the Instagram. Before we go any further, I was trying so hard to get the latest episode out on time that I completely just neglected to mention the passing of Congressman John Lewis, who passed away on July 17th. And man, I'm kind of kicking myself for missing that. But, you know, John Lewis was definitely a hero of mine. John Lewis holds a special place in my heart. I actually produced a short clip about John Lewis for A History of Black Excellence, which, by the way, if you're not following A History of Black Excellence, you should do so on Instagram or Facebook. But, you know, I wrote and produced a video about John Lewis. I'm pretty sure that most of us listening know that John Lewis was a very successful politician, but he was also a prominent civil rights activist as well. One of his more notable protests, and, you know, definitely one of the biggest ones, so big that they made a movie of it. But on March 7th, 1965, John Lewis led over 600 protesters across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, protesting for civil rights. And as the marchers made it across the bridge, they were met by Alabama state troopers who savagely beat these protesters. John Lewis actually suffered a fractured skull from that incident, and he was heading the line that was leading the march. If you've never seen that clip, if you've never seen clips of that footage before, you know, I dare you to look at that and say, well, they shouldn't have been blocking the street, you know? And, you know, sometimes I look at footage like that and, you know, it's the same people that say that they, you know, back then, you know, they would be on the right side of history back then. Sometimes I get a little discouraged because I feel like those same people are actually really showing their true colors now. I feel like those same people are showing you what side that they would really be on in today's times. And so when I hear that, I'm sorry, but sometimes, a lot of times I kind of shake my head and disagree, because it really does take a lot to check off your comfort zones and to stand up for what's right. takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength and a lot of heart to do that. And so when I hear people just casually and willy-nilly talking about how they would have marched with Dr. King or they would have marched with John Lewis, it does give me some pause. But rest in peace to John Lewis, a hero and an activist. And, you know, the spirit of John Lewis's activism, it continues to carry on in today's times. And hey, let's take a slight detour even. So even in sports, activism is continuing. And speaking of sports, I just want to say something real quick. If you haven't seen it yet, or if you didn't already know, on the first day of baseball, and forgive me, you guys, I don't watch baseball regularly. I think they call the first day of baseball like opening day or something like that. But anyway, on the first baseball game of the season, by now I'm sure we've all seen the footage or the picture. Maybe we watched the game and saw the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox players all kneeling before the game, right? All kneeling in honor of Black Lives and Black Lives Matter. And I'm not going to lie. You know, there are a lot of days where I'm over the symbolism. There are a lot of days where I'm really past the symbolism, and you know, I'm ready for real policy change. I'm ready for real change in law that is going to provide a more equal opportunity for everybody, including Black folks. So, you know, anyway, I didn't watch the game. Like I said, I don't watch baseball, but I did see that image. And you want to know what I thought about? So, I'm sorry, baseball fans, but the truth is, some of the most racist experiences that I personally have ever had in the workplace or in a professional setting were encounters with folks that just happen to be avid baseball fans. So please know, I'm not insinuating that most baseball fans are racist or whatever. I'm definitely not even trying to connect the two sports, but just hear me out. You know, again, it just so happens to be that a lot of those Dexter do-gooders that would corner me in the office, a lot of those folks were the same kind of people that would say things like protesters deserve to get hit by cars if they're marching in the streets. And it just so happens that these are the same kind of dudes that were super de-duper baseball fans, right? And so as I saw these images online of these two baseball teams, and you had every single team kneeling, you know, I just busted out laughing because I'm not a petty person, but sometimes I have petty moments. And as I was watching that, I was thinking about those folks, and I was thinking, so you are you boycotting baseball this year? You know, when I saw that image with all those baseball players kneeling, it instantly took me back to that office setting, you know, back to that bullpen, and made me imagine what kind of conversations I would have had to endure while working around those people. And I guarantee you that I probably would have started some shit. I probably would have piped up and said, hey, are you guys boycotting baseball this year? You know, your heroes get it. Your Yankees get it. Your Red Sox get it. Your Cardinals get it. Your Chicago Cubs get it. These people are kneeling because they believe that Black Lives Matter. They believe that your Black Lives Matter put downs are whack. They believe that your BLM put downs are racist. So how about now? Are you boycotting baseball now? I'm just curious. But, you know, anyway, like I said, I'm not a petty person, but sometimes I have petty moments, okay? Look, I love sports, and I do think it's really cool to see some of these larger symbols and to see these professional athletes use their platform that is being viewed by so many millions of people to speak up against the injustices towards Black folk, and bringing awareness to not only Black Lives Matter, but also talking about some of these stories that are plaguing us and haunting us every day. The cops that killed Breonna Taylor, for instance, are still at large and still living life just fine, pretty comfortably. That's a message that our friends in the NBA are talking about a lot. As this episode is being recorded, today is actually the start of the resuming of the NBA season. And I gotta admit, I really love what the NBA is doing to show their support and to demonstrate their support for the remainder of this NBA season. A lot of the players have opted to wear anti-racist messages or the names of Black victims of police violence on the backs of their jerseys. Pella Iowa's own Kyle Korver, who plays for the Milwaukee Bucks, has opted to wear Black Lives Matter on the back of his jersey. And I hope that his hometown of Pella, Iowa, views that man as a hero or as an activist for doing this. And I hope they don't just dismiss him as some sort of race baiter. Again, I'm a lifelong Iowan, and just recalling some of the experiences that I've had in towns like the town that he's from, you know, I just kind of can imagine some of the worst parts of those conversations. But, you know, I really hope that that a seed is planted with what our local guy is doing, as far as utilizing his platform to spread the message of Black Lives Matter. So, that's my sports rant. Why am I talking about sports? Why am I talking about activism? I mean, it all comes full circle as far as teeing up this next guest. So our guest that's about to join us, Jordan Weber, I mentioned that he's an activist. He's an artist. He's a fine artist. But the sports connection is real. He's from my hometown in Des Moines. And this dude was the guy for sports, the basketball star, you know. And we all thought we'd see him, you know, in the big league someday, you know. But but life has a funny way of showing us what we're really meant here to do. And so that's the friend of my friend, or I'm sorry, that's the story of my friend Jordan, you know, an athlete turned artist turned activist. It's a beautiful story. So without further ado, here's my guy, Jordan Weber.
I always get freaking nervous. I don't know why.
That's kind
All right. Hey, guys, we're back with the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast, and we are joined by a very distinguished guest. We've got artist / activist Jordan Weber. Jordan, what's up, man?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, man, just taking it easy, man. Trying to get my quarantine on like everybody else, big dog. Trying not to go crazy though.
Yeah, I feel you.
how's quarantine treating your family? Or I know it's gotta be kind of hard quarantine for an artist.
It is, but I've been traveling with full protective gear, though, so there's a lot of projects going on right now all over the Midwest with everything that's going on. So there's a lot of protocol with N95 masks, so I've been moving around pretty slyly. I feel like I'm being safe. Obviously, I haven't got COVID yet, but it's busy. Not for, you know, my daughter and my wife. They're pretty much in lockdown, but I got to keep it moving.
I feel you, man. I feel you. My wife is actually a dental hygienist, man, so... So now, if you were to see her at work, she looks like a straight up surgeon for real.
Oh yeah, I can see. That's like the worst spot to be in somebody's mouth right now. So
word. So, Jordan, introduce yourself, man. Tell tell the audience, tell the chips out there, a little bit about yourself and where you're from and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I'm from North Des Moines. Went to Meredith and Hoover with my guy Larry. Used to hoop. Yep, used to hoop pretty heavily. Got injured. Turned around to art. That was always my backup plan. Art lent itself to activism because of roots with my parents, especially my father being a community organizer. And now I you know, would consider myself an environmental justice / social justice artist who activates landscapes through art, really. That's me in a nutshell.
Yeah. And when this guy says that he used to hoop, I mean, this dude was a baller for real. This guy was the first. I used to only see this stuff on TV, but I swear you were the first high school baller that I ever saw with my own eyes with a tattoo.
Oh shit! Yeah, man, I got my tat early too, man. I got mine early. I think I got my tattoo when I was like 17.
That was like a grown man tattoo, man.
Yeah, I went big with it, man. I probably went too big because I don't like it now.
Did you say you hate it now?
It's comedy. I don't like it now, man, because I drew my own Chinese characters. I had no business doing that, so it's a little rough looking nowadays.
Oh, okay. I see you. Okay.
That's when I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll share this with the audience, man. I have two tattoos, and I got one when I was 18. I got one when I was 19. And I hate them both. I hate them both.
Yep.
And honestly, if I were to lift up my left arm, you probably couldn't even see the tattoo anymore, because both of my tattoos are in brown ink.
Oh shit! Yeah. What? Who talked you into that one,
bro? I was on some hippie shit, man. So this was back when earth tones were a thing and like certain browns
and reds.
You know, and I kind of wanted to do like some hippie / like henna kind of style thing. And yeah.
Well, you could cover those up now. Those would be good cover ups.
You know what, man? I think I'm just going to leave these hideous things on here. And I tell my kids all the time, I tell all five of them, even the baby, I say, if you guys ever get a tattoo, you're out the will.
You're going to have a tough time with that, man.
I know.
Prevalent. They're so prevalent. Like, yeah. Like when we were coming up and Iverson was really like, you know, pushing the tattoo game forward, like,
yeah.
It's as common as getting a new kicks now. So you're going to have a fight with that one.
No doubt. So, man, so like I said, though, man, you were a big deal, to us here in Des Moines as far as the hooping and the athletics. And, talk to me a little bit more about the transition. I don't think a lot of people really know this. How did you go from being like this, you know, top athlete dude to jumping in the art thing?
Well, like I was saying a couple of days ago, I was doing another interview. I always tell that story of like having art as a very organic, you know, part of my life, because my mom was an art major at Drake, and I grew up, you know, drawing and painting to like X-Men on Saturdays in my apartment complex off of 31st on the north side. So like, I always had that in me, and you know, getting injured as a collegiate athlete is a hell of a thing when you don't have any other options. And we see this all the time, right? We see ex-teammates going through what happens when you don't make it as an athlete. Like the skill sets that you've acquired over the first 20 years of your life are really predominantly based around your athletic ability. So I literally, when I was done hooping, didn't have anything but art to fall back on. So, you know, working construction and, you know, having these shitty, really physical jobs with long hours pushed me into doing art very heavily, because I knew that I had to do something, because I was not going to last the route that I was going, selling bud and doing construction at night. and painting, you know, in between those little cracks. I knew I really had to make it as an artist, or I was not going to be a happy human being. And I don't even know what type of situation I would be in right now. So, you know, by the grace of God, I've been able to come into a realm of doing art full time and on a large scale nationally. That's really saved me, I think, in a lot of ways. When you think that you're going to make it big, you know, and everybody tells you you're going to make it big, and then, you know, the world tells you otherwise, and you come to find out that you were ill-informed on multiple levels. It's not a pretty transition, you know. But, you know, I'm out of that and in the light now, so I'm not mad about it. But it was always just such a natural thing for me to, like, just draw and to paint, and I didn't really even think of it as art. I was just doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us grow up doing that, but you don't make that leap to, you know, the fine art category ever in the city. Really, I mean, I don't know who else is doing it besides your homeboy, BJ. And he's doing this thing right now, too, with murals and all that, with Be More Art. So, I mean, there's very few of us. And I think this new generation, with some of these kids that are coming out of the BLM movement, like, there's a lot of new art coming out of that. Because, you know, as we've seen throughout the entire world, when things get really heavy for communities, art seems to be a great decompression point. And I think that artists are born out of a lot of oppression. So I think we're getting that more right now, and Des Moines specifically.
Yeah, yep. Definitely, man. And you're right. That's a correlation that I've noticed as well. A lot of this pain and a lot of what we've been going through has produced some very remarkable art.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah, that's huge. So you take on this interest of mm-hmm. you know, dabbling with the arts, right? And you start to put some stuff together, you know, you start selling pieces, right? Now my guess, I could be totally wrong, but my guess is that, you know, at some point your message became a little bit more defined and a little bit more targeted, right? Talk to me about that moment when things started to click. Like, man, I'm gonna make this message with my art. I'm gonna do this with my art.
Yeah, man. Like the story of that, I always look back and kind of, I still fight with that to this day, because when I was really getting into the scene of showing at galleries in Des Moines and at galleries in, like, Omaha, you know, these small spaces, I was doing street art at first, and all the stuff I was doing, I was wheat pasting, and wheat pasting is, for the people that are listening that don't know, is kind of like an ancient form of propaganda. So, like, you make a paste out of wheat flour with water, and then you boil it down, and it's essentially a homemade glue, and you print out these big images, whatever you want. You could draw on anything, any type of thin paper, and you paste it up onto a wall. So, you know, we saw this street art movement happening in, like, 2008, 2007, 2010. And when I was doing all that stuff, I had, you know, these different names I was going by. A lot of the names I get clowned on to this day, because they're really corny names.
Give me one.
But all those,
give me one.
Milk was one of them. Milk. M-I-L-K. Yeah, Milk.
Okay. It's
Milk, man. Super corny. You can laugh if you want, man.
Hey, no. Hey, listen, bro. I was trying to be a rapper back in the day, man. My rap
yeah,
name,
I remember.
My rap name was Lars the Star.
That's very porn. That's very porn story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you took it a different route. Either way, you don't know,
bro.
Though. You think something's ill when you're that young, you know, and you think you got shit figured out when you're like 20, 21, and you really don't.
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
so I mean, it's comedy looking back. But I remember you and Akil at some, what club was that? I think it was in Ankeny.
Oh.
We came through from college, and y'all were doing Akil was up on stage. You were DJing. it was like a little, it was dope though, man. It was dope. I think I think his brother Brian was doing something too, right?
That's exactly what it was. It was his brother Brian was in a rap group,
yep.
and I was kind of trying to rap too, and
Des Moines boys.
Yep, Des Moines boys. Yeah, I DJed at that little club. I wasn't really a DJ. I just I would press play on the CD. That was about it. And sometimes me and Akil would sub in as like hype men. But shout out to Brian Clark and the Des Moines boys.
Yeah, Naeem's down deep in Houston. Getting back to that though, man, like the street art game, like I always had this message of environmentalism when I was doing it. Mm. So I was putting these like extinct animals, you know, with like graffiti tags all over them up on corporate buildings. So I was like getting up on Principal downtown. My brother was going out with me because I was living in my brother's basement at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And really I started transitioning to Canvas because I knew there was money in it, but that message was like anti-capitalism. So it was all this like reverse pop art, you know, like a lot of corporate logos crossed out, you know, like black Mickey Mouses getting squashed by some sort of, you know, corporate entity. So all that stuff kind of had the same content as now, but it was really blatant and on the nose. But I was selling work at that time because I had a good enough understanding of what capitalism, you know, was in the art world, where I knew if I did it a certain way with these bright colors and poured epoxy resin all over these paintings and make them shiny, I can flip them really quickly into, you know, something bigger that I wanted to do, which was murals. So that was the transition. It was like street art to canvas work to big canvas work, and then I was getting money to do murals, you know, and then that ultimately led to me getting grants from the Iowa Arts Council in Des Moines, who's kind of held me down throughout the years. And then that kind of just bled into getting, honestly, Larry, just getting completely fed up. And I always was, but even more fed up and enraged at the amount of police brutality that we were starting to see on social media consistently, especially on like World Star Hip Hop.
Yeah.
So like once these videos started getting shown more and more, you would just sit there and watch YouTube. Like we already knew all this was going down, but you never saw the graphic videos consistently. So that transition, I was just like conditioning myself to make more and more effective work. And then boom, 2014 hit and Mike Brown was murdered, you know. And then I went down with Gawalo, my homeboy from Minneapolis, who you know, who's back and forth between Minneapolis and Des Moines. We went down to Ferguson and protested the first phase one when it was at its heaviest. And that's when everything kind of took a huge turn into doing, you know, the really refined work that you're talking about in terms of the ideology of my work and the philosophy of the work and really pinpointing specific things that I can really utilize art as an object for change within Des Moines specifically, and then it grew from there. So I would say 2014 was when everything was kind of honed in and really laser focused on enacting change through art.
Yeah. Man, that's interesting, because the way that you describe that, you know, for me, I had a breakthrough in 2016, 2 years later, with the deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile.
Yeah.
And
yep.
That was kind of like my awakening, you know. That's when I knew, like, okay, something is different, and I can't just sit here on the sidelines. And it's crazy because you're probably experiencing this now too. Now it's 2020. Mm-hmm. Now we have George Floyd. You're probably seeing now a whole other wave of black folks that are that are changing and working towards some type of activism in their own way.
Yeah, and it's so much bigger now too than it was in 2014, because we tried to organize consistently here in Des Moines for protests, and we just did not have the energy behind it, because, you know, in all reality, our white allies needed to see, you know, the blatancy of the murders happening on video, because they're still on the fucking fence the whole time, even though everybody knew the shit was going down.
Yeah.
You saw the blatancy of the 8, you know, minute and 45 second video to really spark a lot of allies coming through to go out into the streets. We didn't have that with Ferguson. And even Tamir Rice, as blatant as that was, too, they were just like, oh, but he had a fake gun, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It was still, you know, not pushed into the psyche to have allies with us. And, yeah, now we have this huge surge of youth, black and brown and indigenous youth uniting with our white allies, and it's just a whole different movement. And Spike Lee just said 2 months ago that he really felt like, it was the 60s, you know, in the Bronx and then Brooklyn and then Queens all over again. He really feels like it's the same exact movement. So
it's crazy
what people need to see on a visual level to really spark, you know, a collaborative aspect of their fellow men in this thing that's, you know, constant oppression in America. So
yeah.
It still blows my mind. I was just at a BLM meeting with the Supply Hive. They're doing a new community garden on 13th and College that I was going to do some work on, but, you know, I'm doing stuff in other cities, so they're taking over that whole entire site. And just
the sheer determination,
these, like, 18 through, like, 26-year-olds that are getting down, it's really inspiring. So they're really sparking something, you know, new and consistent for, I think, the older heads that have been doing this. It's like, all right, yeah, dope. Here we go again. Like, now we got more cats mm-hmm. on board doing it in a bigger way. So,
yeah.
You know, everything feels like it's moving at a much more rapid pace than it was in 2014, 2015, 2016.
Yeah, I think things are different, man. I think
uh-huh.
so since my awakening in 2016, right? So I just think about my own journey that I've been on, and, you know, sometimes going blue in the face, expressing like how things really are, even though your audience doesn't believe you or dismisses you or whatever. And now it's like, you know, after you know, going blue in the face for 4 years now, these people are coming back full circle. Dang,
exactly.
You were right. You know,
yep.
And so that's crazy. But I agree, though. I agree with Spike Lee, man. And ever since the beginning of this, I've been, you know, I created like this little digital album on my iPad, and I'm describing
mm-hmm.
screen records and pictures. You know, I have not. I have not been to a protest here, and I have total admiration and love and respect
mm-hmm.
for everyone that has. I would
mm-hmm.
love to make it to one. I just have not had I haven't made the opportunity to go yet. But one of these days
mm-hmm.
I will. But I've just been, like, you know, documenting as much as I can and just kind of putting this all together. Because
mm-hmm.
I just feel like at some point, man, when the kids all grow up and they look back at this time, you know, a couple things are going to happen, man. They're either going to hear about, you know, this great time that was, you know, 2020, where everyone came together to fight this shit, or they're going to read something crazy in their textbooks that's going to be
exactly.
completely not what this was. But bam, I'm going to have all this stuff.
I think, you know, that brings up a couple points. For one, I see huge, with my wife being in the Des Moines Public Schools, I see a lot of talk about teaching accurate Black history in our classes as a commonality. And we never heard of that before. But for two, back to you not going to the protest, like, we've been talking about this too. Like, everybody's protesting on their own platform and in their own ways. And this podcast is, you know, its own form of protest in and of itself too. So, I mean, as long as people are doing something to activate a landscape or activate radio waves or activate their community and vacant lots, like, as long as you're out doing something and in the form of protest or civil disobedience for long-term sustainable direct action, I think, you know, we're on the right course. And I really truly think that our kids are going to look back and see us as, you know, the summer of 68, you know, 69 into the 70s. Like, I really think it's going to be a historical time evolving of U.S. society. And honestly, I don't think it's by any means over in terms of the violence that's going to happen, because you'd already know what's going to happen with these elections with the Trumpers out there and cats picking up arms. I just saw last night on the news, man, with armed black citizens and armed white militia down in Arkansas, I think it was, that were standing off with everybody had assault rifles of different, you know, calibers and different makes and models.
Yeah.
You know, just staring at each other, like 50-50 on each side. And I'm like, I really feel like if one of them cats shot, like, that would have sparked this huge violent racial conflict throughout the U.S. And we're and I don't think we're out of the woods because I was just in the at the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis after they burned the precinct down, and there were white supremacists walking all over, and there were white supremacists, as this is well documented, with full-blown, you know, militia gear on, shooting into neighborhoods, into the ground, so military would go into black neighborhoods. So there's all this other shit happening, and I don't think we're out of the woods with that by any means, but I think that's going to be part of this, you know, evolution of, you know, us moving forward in some way, shape, or form. And like you said before, I really think our kids are going to look back and see it as you know, this 68 summer. Sure. I really do.
For sure, man. Yeah, we're definitely not out of the woods yet. So, my man, this is the only chip in the cookie podcast, right? So I kind of want to take things in a different, kind of a different direction, man. But, you know, being from Des Moines, obviously you have ties here, right? So obviously your art is going to be on display here. I've been to a lot of your shows here in Des Moines. I think the biggest show of yours that I've been to was at the Art Gallery, right?
Yep.
And I remember, honestly, man, I remember thinking, you know, so before I went, I was thinking, okay, whoa, the Art Gallery. You know,
you're talking about the Des Moines Art Center. That's
the Art Center. Art Center. Yeah, the Art Center. That's the Art Gallery. Yeah, the Des Moines.
Because you and Nikhail came and held it down. So I specifically remember you at that one.
Yes. Art Center. But I just remember thinking, like, what is this experience going to be like? Because, you know, I know you as my man, and you're the artist, but to me, I'm just going to be a black dude in the crowd. What does a black dude wear to an art show? I don't know. and then of course, you know, and of course we get there and so obviously, you know, there's going to be a lot of white folks pretty much anywhere in Des Moines. Right. Mm-hmm. So as you unveil and talk about and describe, this black pain, and some of these emotions, man, I gotta ask, man, do things ever get kind of maybe uncomfortable for you, or does the room ever get a little tense, you know, like specifically with the white folk?
Oh yeah. I mean, if you go to any art exhibition, the majority of them, the most uncomfortable person in the room is going to be the artist, because for one, we're butt naked because we have all of our, you know, everything that is trapped, you know, in a mental state floating around in our head, the most intimate of thoughts and things are on the wall, you know, so you're literally naked.
Yeah.
So that exhibition would be a lot different now, because like we were talking about before, we have more white allies now than we ever have in the past two decades. So in terms of this activist movement and police brutality. So at that exhibition, like, I needed y'all there because I was speaking to police brutality, and there was probably only 10 of us in the crowd of 90, right? So it is tense because I'm talking about black empowerment and police brutality to a group of white folks, and how do you do that in a way that's productive when, you know, 80-90% of the audience is white? It is tense. And I got word after that from a professor at Drake, and she said, oh, I didn't make it to the, you know, the talk, but, you know, I heard it was okay. Like, yeah, you heard it was okay, because I can't get into a huge discourse and an intimate right. discourse and a sea of white folks that are going to engage. You know, they're going to downplay the oppressive, you know, energy that we feel on a daily basis. So, mm-hmm. like, for one, you know, fuck you for even mentioning that, because that was hella aggressive. And for two, like you don't even know what it's like to be speaking on blackness in a white space like that, in the most prolific space in Iowa for the arts. So it's tense, because I'm sitting there making eye contact with the majority of white folks.
Yeah.
And if you could see when I was speaking at that lecture around the work, as we had a young brother by the name of Trey, who's about 280 pounds of mm-hmm. muscle, lifting a cop car up and down as a piece of a weight equipment, that said NYC on one side of the cop car and Ferguson on the other side of the cop car. You know, I was gravitating towards that and the black audience and my black homeboys on the right hand side. So it very much was a gravitational pull over to my comfort zone in that space, even though it is my show, right? So mm-hmm. I think it was you and Akil both spoke, and you two were the only ones to speak when I asked if anybody had to anything to add to this conversation. I think one white cat spoke too, but I mean, you would have that, you know, times 10, I would assume, if we had that happen today, which we are. There's a show opening at the Des Moines Arts Center October 2nd, and COVID's really going to push it into a different space, but it's going to be all black and brown artists from the Des Moines Arts Center collection. And yeah, it's going to be a pretty prolific and intense exhibition for black artists in Des Moines. So we're going to be advertising that soon, but you'll see a whole different, you know, population at this show versus that one. So
yeah,
it's always difficult in Des Moines to speak about blackness to a sea of white and a sea of whiteness.
Mm-hmm. My brother, I can relate. I've talked extensively about that scenario, that type of scenario on this podcast.
Yep. And I know, you know, because that's, you know, I'm sure you're dealing with that at work every single day.
So, man, I just watched this awesome clip produced by a Blade of Grass organization. They put out this awesome clip. I'm sure it's everywhere. I saw it on Instagram. And it talks about a project that you did in Omaha, Nebraska, with regards mm-hmm. to a greenhouse and Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about this project and really, really describe it for me? I kind of positioned it like that so you can fill in the blanks.
Yeah. So that project has been in the works for probably 6 years in North Omaha, which is connected to the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation. And as us Midwesterners know, Malcolm X is from North Omaha. Born in North Omaha. So this greenhouse that I built is to be in the shape of his birth home that sits on about 7 acres of land in the hood, basically, in North Omaha. That is a food desert. The soil is heavily contaminated around it with heavy metals like lead, mercury, arsenic. So the idea behind this project was to create a space in collaboration with the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation to be, you know, black on a sacred site, but to be in a position to be able to grow your own clean food on clean land. But not only that, the space is really a place to meditate and practice Salah prayer, because the ex-president was Muslim, so he had prayer sessions on that location. So this provided a space for that, for the community. And the front porch is positioned true east towards Mecca. But also the idea of the space, because, you know, COVID's really pushed back a lot of programming. So we're really in a situation right now where we're reintroducing programming once COVID goes away, or, you know, the vaccines come out, or whatever the approach is going to be to fight COVID. But one of the elements of the programming is to allow a space on a green site with a lot of prairie grass and indigenous plants to decompress and really center ourselves in oppressive elements that are redlined that don't have access to clean food and do not have a lot of green space, which, as we know, with a lot of studies that have been done, has proven to be a huge point of health for the Black and Brown and Indigenous psyche to be in green space, especially if we're from urban areas that don't have a lot of plants and trees. So the idea is really this space to reactivate one's soul from a mental and physical standpoint to be on a sacred site. And that's really the identity of the entire project. It's a decompression point to do Zazen meditation. Zazen meditation, to keep it brief, is the practice of sitting still and focusing on breathing. You know, what we see central to our movement right now is just breathing in space-time to calm one mind and to let go of all the things around you and not think. So if you combine that with food that's being grown in this greenhouse and this green space that you can then view from inside this greenhouse, you really have the totality of health in one space on, you know, the very foundation of where Malcolm X was born and took his first step. So it's an extremely powerful project that has been a huge collaboration with a lot of amazing Black organizations in North Omaha. And it's still kind of in flux right now, like I said. So yeah. I know there's a lot of elements of it, but just think of, you know, replenishment and self-determination on Malcolm X's birth site. That's really what the project is.
It looks amazing. I haven't had an opportunity to check it out yet, but I do have some family out in Omaha, so it's definitely in the cards to go check it out. Omaha, Nebraska is about a couple hours from Des Moines, Iowa, so it's really, yeah, really close to us. So why Malcolm X? Malcolm X is one of my favorite civil rights stories. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I love kind of how he had this transformation about, mm-hmm, you know, kind of midway into his prominence. But tell me about your connection with Brother Malcolm.
Yeah, so, you know, I spoke earlier on having a tendency to have a huge temper, especially growing up, and just like, you know, my brother and, you know, the cats that grew up around our neighborhood, like, fighting was, you know, commonplace. And, you know, the Webbers are just known for being hot blooded in general. So when my dad exposed us to all these great, you know, leaders and now kings and gods in our psyches of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, those are the two that we had exposure to the most, right?
Yeah.
And I always just felt more of a pull to him saying, you know, be peaceful, be respectful, be vigilant. But then he says, if somebody puts your hands on you, send them to the fucking morgue. And that shit was like the most flame, like verse that I feel like I had ever heard when I was a kid. I was like, yeah, man, like, I related to that so much more than the peaceful protesting,
yeah,
of Martin Luther King. But when I got older, I also realized that, you know, cats like Stokely Carmichael would say, you know, like, black, he coined the phrase, you know, Black power. And yeah, the idea of breaking away from these, you know, systems of oppression and creating our own space. Mm-hmm. Like, they were just more militant in that fashion, and I've always just felt much more of a connection to those two specifically and their teachings than anybody else. And, you know, I was like the kid that was like raised in a Christian household, mm-hmm, and, you know, read Gandhi and was into that whole thing, and I would consider myself a Buddhist over anything else to this day.
Yeah.
But I just think that there's a split. When you have a physical threat, especially, you know, with occupying elements in our communities like police, I feel like there's just a line that you cannot cross. And it's when you threaten somebody's body to the point of taking them off this earth and away from their daughters and their sons and their, you know, their siblings and their partners and their parents, that you have every right to physically preserve life by any means. So that's that's why Malcolm X. I mean, that cat has always been the coldest, the most like militant and truthful and in your face cat that it just always stuck with me a lot more for the reasons I stated before. So really that and you know, going to Omaha, my wife's family's from Omaha. So that was always like this retreat. Yeah. And they still live in Omaha. So that was always a retreat for me to like, go there and get away from her family a little bit and just kind of be on that site.
Yeah.
And that site for somebody who hasn't been there is it used to be an all black neighborhood, and Malcolm X's, you know, family house was burned down.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole street was really annexed by the city. It was given up on by the city, and nature just really took over that whole entire property. Wow. So if you go to the site, yeah, you still see street signs sunken into the ground, light posts that say, you know, the street name. But then you have the, you know, reclaiming of nature, and it's all this indigenous prairie grass. So like going to this space has always been like a spiritual retreat for me as well. So it was always that site that led to this project also, you know, with Malcolm X's teachings and that being in my psyche. So it's always been kind of this mecca for me to build something on that site. And it took me 5 years, easily 5 or 6 years, to build with Joanna LaFleur, who's the keystone to the whole project and the vice president of the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation, to even ask her blessing to propose the project to the Malcolm X Memorial Committee to get something going on that site. So all those things kind of led to the physical building of that structure.
Yeah. Well, man, that's awesome.
Was that too aggressive? I feel like I was being mad aggressive.
No, bro, okay. Come on, man. Nah. Hey, man, look, we white folks are going to learn, all right? When we get passionate, all right, we get a little loud, okay? It's all right. It's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what this is all about, brother. We're just passionate. Well, yeah, I've seen lots of beautiful imagery of this greenhouse / meditation space, and I think it's I think it's so dope that it's official too, that it was co-signed by the foundation, you know. And I'll have some links to that in the podcast description and in my Instagram as well for those of you guys to,
okay.
I would encourage you guys to go and check that out. Well, Jordan, man, this has been so fun, just catching up with an old friend. And, you know, I've got to say, I'm very, very proud of the work that you're doing. It is fine art, and it's just refreshing. It's powerful. It's unique, and I would really implore all of you guys to check out Jordan's work and to, you know, if he's doing a show in your hometown or if, you know, a few states over, make sure you check out what he's got going on. Jordan, just real quick, man, can you tell us, why don't we do this? So what's next on the horizon for you? I know you talked about, a big event in October, but, what's next in the cards, man?
Well, right now, man, the biggest thing is, you know, this project, but day after the precinct burned down in Minneapolis, I was on the north side of Minneapolis with, you know, our black and indigenous brethren up there breaking ground on a urban farm that I got commissioned to build in the form of a basketball court on a vacant lot in collaboration with Youth Farms at the North Minneapolis and the Walker Art Center, which is one of the biggest museums in the entire U.S., so that's really what I'm doing right now. And that's the thing that's been, you know, the closest thing, to our hometown and the closest thing to my heart, you know, putting hands in soil and literally building from the ground up with a lot of our allies and collaborators. So that project, man, there's so many dope things going on in that project that are similar to the Forum X Greenhouse that we can speak on at another time, but if anybody wants to know more about that, just hop on my Instagram page, because there's links to the Walker Art Center on it. And that's really the best way to keep up with what I'm doing is just my Instagram account. So,
give us the ID.
Man, it's like Jordan _J_Weber. Something like that, I think.
I think that's what it is too. I'll have it in the description as well. I'll have it in the description.
Okay.
But it's Jordan_J_Weber with one B.
Yep. And that links us, you know, that's really been the thing that's linking a lot of us right now is Instagram. So I get more collaborative approaches from Instagram than anything else. So it's really wild how that platform has really been helping the movement.
You know what?
In general, I'm not,
You actually put me on Instagram, man, believe it or not. Like,
did I?
Yeah. Oh. So I've always kind of been on Instagram and stuff like that, you know. But see, you taught me about engagement because you said something to me one time. You were like, we posted your work in Facebook or something like that. And I also put it on IG too. And you're kind of checking, you're like, okay, cool. You got it on IG too. All right. That's where all the comments are. That's where all the comments are. And that is huge, man, because it's one thing to have a whole bunch of followers, man. But you know, you want to have an engaging audience, you know, you want to collaborate with your audience and you want to do business with your audience, you know? So
you're right.
So yeah,
exactly.
No, you totally put
that's where all the curators. And that's where all the curators are at, man. That's where the museum directors are at. Like, you know, that's where you get the direct messages. Like, I'm not, like, we're up here hyping up Instagram way too much right now, but like, you know, it has been a very effective tool as of late. So I mean, yeah, I don't know how I put you on IG. I couldn't have been the only one, but I just got introduced to the only chip in the cookie, like, 2 weeks ago by my man Julian that you had on first. So I mean,
Coach
I see you got, yeah, man, Coach Jay. So that's the homie. And so I see you're doing your thing on there, and I can't wait to see what else you got and who else you got on.
Listen, I appreciate it, big dog. It's been a lot of fun, you know, having lots of conversation with people about, you know, being black in these white spaces. So it's been real. Well, this has been too real. So I really appreciate it, man. And I look forward to seeing your works to come, man.
I appreciate it, man. And yeah, it's always nice to run into you. And we need to have our families go to that Malcolm X site when everything's over, man. And we're safe and we can travel.
Yes, sir. I'm down. All 20 of us. Cool. All right.
Exactly.
Well, hey. Thanks a lot, everyone, for listening. And until next time, everyone, be well.